junk machine was feeding to its competitors. Forsman's firm was simply eclipsed by the scale of the Drexel operation. The competition between it and KKR had now transcended the win-loss column. Forsman would privately rant that Kravis, that little fart, was leading the buyout business's race to perdition. Kravis, for his part, was quoted snarkily telling associates that Forstmann suffered from an Avis complex. Chapter 4. Who are you guys? On October 1, 1985, weeks after the Lynx Club Accord that sprung Schwartzman from Shearson, Peterson and Schwartzman formally launched the Blackstone Group, with Peterson as chairman and Schwartzman as CEO. The name, Schwartzman's invention, reflected their ethnic roots, combining the English equivalents of Schwartz, German and Yiddish for black, and Peter, Greek for stone. They opened an office on the 34th floor of the Seagram building, the elegant Mies van der Rohe and Philip Johnson-designed skyscraper on Park Avenue just north of Grand Central Station. Their quarters were conspicuously austere, just 3,067 square feet, which they outfitted with two desks and a used conference table. There was one other employee, Peterson's secretary. The funding was similarly frugal, $400,000, half from each partner, to pay Blackstone's bills until cash started coming in. That was nothing to Peterson, who had pocketed more than $13 million in severance pay, and from his cut of the money from Lehman's share to Shearson. Schwartzman, too, had made a bundle, $6.5 million, from the sale of his Lehman shares. But though the amount they staked to Blackstone was comparatively small, they were determined not to risk any more. They worried that if they ran through the money before Blackstone started to pay for itself, it would bode ill for their venture. It was the same cautious approach to risking money that would become a hallmark of Blackstone's investing style, and helps explain why Blackstone avoided the kind of brazen, outsized gambles that caused some high-flying rivals to run aground. Schwartzman and Peterson had a breakfast ritual, convening at 8:30 nearly every morning in the cafeteria of the former Mayfair Hotel on 65th Street and Park Avenue, now the site of the celebrated restaurant Danielle. There they mapped out their plans for a hybrid business, part M&A boutique, part buyout shop. They had no wish to emulate investment banks or brokerage firms, which need sturdy capital foundations to back the commitments they make to their clients and to tide them through when they lose money in the markets. We didn't want to have a lot of capital tied up in low-margin businesses, Schwartzman says. We wanted to be in business where we could either drive very high assets per employee or operate with very high margins. Giving M&A advice was the ultimate high-margin work. Enormous fees with very little overhead. Managing a buyout fund was appealing because a relatively small team could oversee a large amount of money and collect a commensurately large management fee along with a share of the profits on the investments. They also hoped to tack on related businesses that made their money from fees. They weren't sure yet what those would be, but they thought they could attract like-minded entrepreneurial types from other niches of the financial world who could benefit from a collaboration. They lacked the dollars to hire top talent, however, or to stake another business. Nor did they want to share the ownership of Blackstone. The memory of the feuding at Lehman was still all too fresh, and they wanted absolute control of their business. The solution they ultimately hit on was to set up new business lines as joint ventures, affiliates, they called them, that would operate under Blackstone's roof. To lure the right people, they would award generous stakes in the ventures. In time, that arrangement was the foundation for two of Blackstone's most successful affiliated businesses, its real estate investment unit, built by John Schreiber, and the bond investment business that was later spun off as BlackRock Incorporated, now one of the preeminent publicly traded investment managers in the world, which Lawrence Fink, who started it, still leads. Such was their long-term vision. But the first task was to land some M&A work to pay the rent. It would take time to raise a fund to invest in buyouts, and years more before the new firm would garner any profits from its investments. In the meantime, Peterson and Schwartzman needed a source of near-term revenue. Their M.O. on the M&A front was the same one they had employed at Lehman. The 59-year-old Peterson, with his entree to executive suites around the country, would get Blackstone in the door, and Schwartzman, then 38, would make the deals happen. Peterson and Schwartzman would cozy up to management to get deal flow. With the financial world polarized by the wave of hostile takeover bids, Peterson and Schwartzman knew that they would have to choose sides. In 1985, the backlash against the Raiders and Drexel had not reached its peak, but it was clear to them how they would ally themselves in the battles over corporate control. From day one, Blackstone pledged its loyalty to management. Drexel was viewed by many in both the business and the financial establishment in a very unfavorable way, because they were like uninvited guests at many parties, and they insisted on staying, Schwartzman says. We wanted to be consistent with what we were doing at Lehman, and we didn't see how we could be counseling corporations one day and then turning around and attacking them the next. We wanted the corporate establishment to trust us. They soon discovered that it was one thing to pitch clients with the prestige of Lehman behind them. It was quite another to win business for a new firm no one had heard of. For several months, they couldn't scare up a single advisory assignment. By the time they landed their first, a project for Squibb Beechnut Corporation in early 1986, the $400,000 they'd started out with had dwindled to $213,000. The Squibb Beechnut job paid them $50,000. A pittance compared with the fees they'd commanded at Lehman, it was manna for the starving. Soon after that, Blackstone won two other assignments that paid modestly more, from Backer and Spielvogel, an advertising agency, and Armco Steel Corporation. We were starting to earn back what we'd been losing, said Schwartzman. Those were the streams of revenue between us and oblivion. Starting in April 1986, Blackstone's M&A work picked up markedly. Yet even as its income rose, the firm continued to bump up against a prejudice in the corporate world against independent M&A boutiques. Not even CSX, which had collected an extra $15 million for its newspaper subsidiary, thanks to Schwartzman's cunning years earlier, was entirely comfortable using Blackstone. CSX supplied Blackstone its first major M&A assignment, hiring it to help craft a takeover offer for Sea Land Corporation, a shipping company that was seeking a friendly buyer after receiving a hostile bid from a corporate raider. However, when it came time to order a fairness opinion, a paid written declaration that a deal is fair, that carries great weight with investors, CSX's chairman Hayes Watkins sought out a brand-name investment bank, Salomon Brothers, instead. Disheartened that his client had looked elsewhere, Schwartzman asked Watkins why he wouldn't accept Blackstone's opinion, when Schwartzman's opinions had always sufficed when they were issued on Lehman's letterhead. I hadn't thought of that, Schwartzman remembers Watkins responding. Schwartzman then prevailed upon Watkins to commission fairness letters from both firms. Though Blackstone hadn't managed to handle the deal solo, at least it won equal billing with the much more established Salomon. At the same time as the two men were selling their services as M&A sages, they were also pounding the pavement, trying to drum up money for a buyout fund. By now, the LBO business was no longer a backwater industry, and many others, including their former Lehman colleague Warren Hellman, were flocking to this hot corner of the investment world. The lure was easy to understand. KKR, the buyout frontrunner, had just collected $235 million, four times what it had invested, selling Golden West, a Los Angeles TV broadcaster. Not long after, KKR pulled off its 27th buyout, capturing a much larger broadcaster, Storer Communications of Miami, for $2.4 billion, setting a new record. But if winning M&A work had been harder than Peterson and Schwartzman had imagined, the fundraising was downright demoralizing. The magic of their collaboration at Lehman, their accomplishments and renown as bankers, meant little now. They'd set a most ambitious target for themselves, a $1 billion fund. KKR, the biggest operator at the time, was managing just under $2 billion. If Blackstone reached its goal, it would smash the record for a first-time fund and rank third behind only KKR and Forstmann Little in the amount of capital it had to invest. Schwartzman admits that the advertised figure was partly bravado, but it served a tactical purpose. Many potential investors had caps that barred them from providing more than, say, 10% of any one fund's capital. By setting a lofty total figure, Schwartzman figured investors might be persuaded to make larger pledges. Moreover, a large fund would throw off a fortune in fees to Blackstone as its general partner. For investing the money it rounded up from insurance companies, pension funds, and other financial institutions, and overseeing the investments, Blackstone would rake in management fees of 1.5% of the fund's capital, or $15 million a year if the fund reached $1 billion. The investors who become limited partners in a partnership don't write a check for their full commitment at the outset. They merely promise to deliver their money whenever the general partner issues a demand, known as a capital call, when it needs money for a new investment. Even so, the general partner collects the full 1.5% from the limited partners every year, no matter how much of the money has been put to work. When the funds themselves begin to wind down after 5 or 6 years, the management fee is substantially reduced. Richer yet was the potential bonanza Blackstone stood to make in carried interest. By the conventions of the business, private equity firms take 20% of any gains on the investments when they are sold. If Blackstone raised the hoped-for $1 billion and the fund averaged $250 million in profits a year, a 25% return, for 5 years running, a not impossible mark, Blackstone would be entitled to $50 million a year, or $250 million over 5 years. On top of that, the companies Blackstone bought would reimburse Blackstone for the costs it ran up analyzing them before it invested, and for its banking and legal fees. Its companies would also pay advisory fees to Blackstone for the privilege of being owned by it. A more lucrative compensation scheme was hard to imagine. The fee structure ensured that if the fund was big enough, the financiers would become millionaires even if they never made a dime for their investors. The management fees alone guaranteed that, with a large fund, if they made good investments and collected their 20% carried interest, they stood to make a lot more. While the individual partners at a successful mid-sized firm such as Gibbons Green Van Amerongen might earn $2 million in a good year, the industry's kingpins, Henry Kravis and George Roberts, overseeing multi-billion dollar funds, each took home upward of $25 million in 1985. This was several times more than what CEOs of Wall Street's most prestigious investment banks made at the time, and it dwarfed what Peterson had earned as CEO of Lehman. Getting their hands on the money in the first place, though, proved to be a struggle for Peterson and Schwartzman. Though LBOs were generating a great deal of talk and curiosity, most pension managers viewed them as too risky. The few investors who had the stomach for LBO funds preferred to place money only with tried-and-true firms, such as KKR, Forstmann Little, and Clayton Dubilier & Rice. Not even a Wall Street grandee like Pete Peterson could overcome that bias. The problem was that a lot of pension fund managers had financial advisors, and the first question they asked us was, "What is your track record?" Peterson says, "Well, we didn't have one. They had to accept us on faith, nothing more. It was one of the toughest things I've ever been involved in." Shortly after they opened shop, they drew up a 2-page promotional letter describing their business plan, which they mailed to hundreds of corporate executives and old Lehman clients. They then waited. And waited. And waited. Pete and I expected business to come flooding in. Of course it didn't, Schwartzman says. We got a few congratulations, nice letter responses. That was it. The pair's fundraising trips were often fruitless. They were treated cavalierly, sometimes boorishly. Schwartzman, who arranged the trips, dragged Peterson with him to pitch the Delta Airlines pension plan in Atlanta one brutally hot day. Their taxi driver got lost and left them to walk the last half mile to the office. Peterson, weighed down with a suitcase, a bulky briefcase, and a suit bag, was drenched in sweat when they arrived. They were greeted by 2 pension officials who escorted them to a room in the basement of the building and offered to get them coffee, and then asked them to chip into the coffee fund. At the end of their long presentation, Peterson and Schwartzman asked for the manager's reaction, only to learn Delta's fund didn't invest in LBO funds. They said they had just wanted to meet us because we were well known, Schwartzman says. The walk back was even hotter than the walk there. I thought Pete was going to kill me. An excursion to Boston was equally galling. They flew there one Friday for a 4 p.m. meeting Schwartzman had lined up with officials at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's endowment. When they arrived at MIT, the receptionist informed them she had no record of the appointment, and there was no one remaining in the office on the eve of the weekend. The 2 partners left, muttering imprecations under their breath. Adding insult to injury, they emerged from the building to find themselves in a torrential downpour with no umbrellas. They retraced their steps in order to call a cab from the endowment office, but it was locked. They took up positions on opposite street corners, hoping to hail a taxi in the driving rain, but to no avail. Finally, Schwartzman, ever the bargainer, rapped on the window of a cab stopped at a red light and offered the passenger a deal. $20 to have the driver take him and Peterson to the airport. It was the only pitch they made that day that succeeded. After months crisscrossing the country, their quest had yielded only a single $25 million pledge from New York Life Insurance Company. 18 institutions they'd considered strong candidates to invest with Blackstone had rebuffed them. By the winter of 1986, a year into the fundraising, they were about out of tricks, says Schwartzman. There were few targets left, so they decided to take a long shot and approached Prudential Insurance. The Pru had close ties to KKR, so they weren't optimistic. It didn't seem the highest probability they'd want to invest with a startup, Schwartzman says. But Peterson had done business with Prudential's chief investment officer, Garnett Keith, and was a close friend of Keith's old boss and mentor, Raymond Charles. He arranged a lunch at Prudential's headquarters in Newark, New Jersey. Keith knew his way around leveraged buyouts, at least as well as Peterson and Schwartzman, having financed 25 to 30 of them by that point. Under Charles, in the 1960s and 1970s, The insurer had become the biggest lender for bootstrap acquisitions of small family-owned businesses in which the buyer borrowed most of the purchase price, the forerunners of buyouts. Keith himself had helped fund a number of KKR's early deals, including the landmark Howdye LBO, for which Prudential furnished nearly a third of the total capital. Over lunch, Keith proved to be receptive. Between bites of a tuna sandwich, he trained his eyes on Peterson and said, "I've thought about this, Pete. We've worked together. I'm going to put $100 million in your fund, and we would like to be the lead investor." Keith, it turned out, had come to believe that Prue was too closely identified with KKR and was, in fact, eager to forge new relationships. Furthermore, Ray Charles had a lot of respect for Pete, and that rubbed off on me, Keith recounts. At last, after more than a year of brush-offs, humiliations, and gnawing doubts about whether Blackstone would make it, Peterson and Schwartzman's luck had turned for the better. They were stunned. "That luncheon was the biggest day of our Blackstone lives," says Peterson. As an anchor investor, Prudential drove a hard bargain, though. Back then, buyout shops laid claim to 20% of the investment profits from each individual company their fund bought. But that meant that if one very large investment in a fund was written off, say an investment that consumed a third of the fund's capital, investors might lose money even though other investments worked out. The manager, though, would still collect profits on the good investments. It was a kind of heads I win, tails you lose clause. Prudential insisted that Blackstone not collect a dime of the profits until Prudential and other investors had earned a 9% compounded annual return on every dollar they'd pledged to the fund. This concept of a hurdle rate, a threshold profit that had to be achieved before the fund manager earns any profits, would eventually become a standard term in buyout partnership agreements. Prudential also insisted that Blackstone pay investors in the fund 25% of the net revenue Blackstone made from its M&A advisory work, even on deals not connected to the fund. At the time, Blackstone still was forking out much of that revenue to Shearson under Schwartzman's severance agreement, which would end the following year. In the end, these were small prices to pay for the credibility the Prue's backing would give Blackstone. The Prudential name could open doors at top financial institutions in the United States and abroad, and Peterson and Schwartzman quickly parlayed Keith's endorsement into further investments. It paid off, particularly in Japan, where Prudential was a major player and where Peterson's status as a former cabinet member carried weight. Peterson was scheduled to give a speech in April 1987 at a gathering of top American and Japanese politicians and business leaders in Tokyo, and he and Schwartzman took advantage of the trip to trawl for money. There, with the help of First Boston and Bankers Trust, top U.S. banks with a presence in Tokyo that Blackstone had hired to help on the fundraising, they lined up meetings with Japanese brokerage houses. Schwartzman knew that brokers like Nomura, Daiwa, and Nikko were hankering to do business on Wall Street, and he hoped Blackstone could leverage its Wall Street lineage into a capital commitment. Schwartzman's hunch turned out to be right. In Tokyo, an exploratory meeting with Yasuo Kanzaki, executive vice president of Nikko Securities, Japan's third largest broker, went well. Kanzaki signaled that Nikko was willing to discuss an investment and asked the two not to talk to any other Japanese brokers. Unbeknownst to Peterson and Schwartzman, First Boston had scheduled a meeting the next morning with one of Nikko's big competitors, Nomura. The two Americans weren't sure what to do. They feared insulting Nomura by canceling on short notice, but didn't want to renege on their word to Nikko. Schwartzman and Peterson called Kanzaki from their car phone outside Nomura's headquarters before the meeting and asked him how to resolve the awkward situation. Kanzaki responded by asking them how much money they wanted. Peterson cupped his hand over the phone while he and Schwartzman discussed how much to ask for. Finally, they settled on $100 million. "No problem," Kanzaki declared. "Done deal." He then suggested they keep their appointment with Nomura so as not to breach Japanese business protocol. Nikko got what it desired from Blackstone, a collaboration to help its tiny band of New York bankers get up to speed on Wall Street. For Blackstone, the surprise investment was even more valuable than it first seemed, for Nikko was part of the Mitsubishi Industrial Group, one of four enormous Japanese business combines that are linked by cross-ownership, commercial synergies, and a shared mindset. As Schwartzman and Peterson trooped to meetings with other parts of the Mitsubishi network, they were greeted warmly. Mitsubishi Trust, Tokyo Marine and Fire, and other group firms ponied up for the new fund. Peterson and Schwartzman hadn't recognized how intimately linked the institutions were when they headed into these meetings. "We'd congratulate ourselves on being such great presenters," Schwartzman says. "I came to realize later we could have sent monkeys in to make those presentations. The fact was, they tended to trust the lead investor, Nikko." Even a member of a rival industrial group, Mitsui Trust, pledged $25 million. He and Peterson headed home with an additional $175 million in hand. Their hot streak continued upon their return. In June, Peterson bumped into an old friend, General Electric Chairman and Chief Executive Jack Welch, at a birthday party for Washington Post publisher Catherine Graham. "Where the hell have you been?" Welch inquired. "I know you and Steve have started this business, and I haven't heard from you." Peterson answered, "Dear God, Jack, we've called and called on GE, and they said you're not interested." Said Welch, "You should have called me directly." Peterson did so the next morning, picking up $35 million. Even more momentous was the $100 million General Motors pension fund put up. GM, like GE, had brushed off Blackstone several times, but a first Boston banker tapped a church connection to get Blackstone access to GM, and the firm soon captured another $100 million pledge. The GM imprimatur brought Blackstone a raft of smaller commitments, $10 million to $25 million from other pension funds. Blackstone had now won anchor investments from three of the most important sources of investment capital at the time: the insurance industry, pension funds, and Japanese financial firms. By early 1987, the Blackstone buyout fund had reeled in a total of more than $600 million. That was well short of their $1 billion target, but Peterson and Schwartzman began to think they should lock that up while they could. It was a perilous time, though it was not yet clear just how perilous. By the second week of October, the stock markets were jittery. Inflation was headed up, fanning talk of an interest rate hike, which would slow the economy and put a damper on a business such as a buyout firm that relied on borrowed money. "I was exceptionally nervous and putting pressure on everyone to close," Schwartzman says. He worked the phones, and on Thursday, October 15, 1987, Blackstone wrapped up the fund at around $635 million, with some mop-up legal work on Friday. The following Monday, the U.S. stock markets nosedived 23%. Black Monday, as it became known, was the biggest one-day drop since 1914, outstripping even the 1929 sell-off that ushered in the Great Depression. If Blackstone hadn't tied up contractual loose ends before the crash, undoubtedly many investors would have backed out. Instead, Blackstone could boast of raising the largest first-time leveraged buyout fund up to that time. No longer would Peterson and Schwartzman live off the unpredictable bounty of M&A fees. Blackstone now would collect 1.5% of the fund's capital every year as a management fee for at least 6 years. This not only ensured Blackstone's near-term survival, but it also meant that Blackstone finally could staff up and take on the trappings of a bona fide business. After an exhausting 2-year struggle, Blackstone had arrived. "We got in just under the wire," Schwartzman says. "It was probably the luckiest moment in Blackstone's history." Chapter 5. Right on Track. Peterson and Schwartzman's new firm had sailed through the 1987 crash in good shape, and they were free of nagging financial worries after raising their fund. But the stretch ahead would be rocky, not just for Blackstone, but for the buyout business as a whole. A treacherous turn in the capital markets and misfires on the deal front would doom some of Blackstone's fellow startups and imperil even some seasoned buyout firms. Through it all, Blackstone would struggle to establish footing. It didn't help that turnover at Blackstone was notoriously high in the early years, owing partly to Schwartzman's mercurial and demanding personality. The young firm, too, would make some bum bets on companies and people, but it would do more right than wrong. With its $635 million safely in the bag, Blackstone immediately ramped up its operations. Soon it spilled over with fresh hires and filing cabinets. In the autumn of 1988, the firm moved to 345 Park Avenue, a bland, hulking, cream-colored skyscraper right across 52nd Street from its former offices in the Seagram Building. It took a 10-year lease on 64,000 square feet, 20 times the size of its original quarters. Surveying the cavernous new expanse, Schwartzman wondered if he'd been batty to sign a lease for so much more space than the firm needed at the moment. In rapid succession, Schwartzman and Peterson recruited 3 high-ranking partners with imposing pedigrees. The first, Roger Altman, 42, the Lehman banker, joined as vice chairman. Peterson and Schwartzman had tried to lure him in 1986 and 1987, but their old colleague held off until Blackstone at last raised its fund and was financially stable. Altman's coyness irked them, but they knew the well-connected banker would be a magnet for M&A fees. Lean, with a shaggy mane and suave manner, Altman was as adept as any Wall Street banker at winning over big-ticket corporate clients. His fascination with public policy clicked with Peterson, even though Altman was a staunch Democrat who had worked on Robert F. Kennedy's 1968 presidential campaign and had put his Lehman career on hold from 1977 to 1981 to work in Jimmy Carter's Treasury Department. In February 1988, Blackstone corralled Lawrence Fink, 35, who had helped create mortgage-backed securities, bonds backed by packages of home mortgages, and built First Boston's successful mortgage securities unit. Securitization, as the process of making bonds out of mortgages was called, transformed the home lending business and created a huge new addendum to the debt markets. The next month, David Stockman, 41, a former Reagan administration budget czar, arrived. As Reagan's first budget director, Stockman, a former 2-term congressman from Michigan, was the point man for the supply-side economics the new administration was pushing, the theory that taxes should be lowered to stimulate economic activity, which would in turn produce more tax revenue to compensate for the lower rates. With his wonky whiz kid persona, computer-like mental powers, and combative style, he browbeat Democratic congressmen and senators who challenged his views. But he soon incurred the wrath of political conservatives when he confessed to Atlantic reporter William Grider that supply-side economics was really window dressing for reducing the rates on high incomes. Among other acts of apostasy, He called doctrinaire supply siders naive. The 1981 article created a sensation and prompted Reagan to ask him over lunch, "You have hurt me. Why?" Stockman famously described the meeting as a trip to the woodshed. Though the president himself forgave him, Stockman's loose lips undercut his power at the White House, and in 1985 he left government to become an investment banker at Salomon Brothers. He was recruited to Blackstone initially by Peterson, who had known Stockman from Washington circles and, like Stockman, was deeply concerned about the federal deficit. Peterson and Schwartzman hoped to put Stockman to work with corporate clients on big-picture strategic, economic, and trade issues, but ultimately he evolved into one of Blackstone's main LBO dealmakers. Fink, tall and engaging, with a shrinking periphery of hair and old-fashioned rimless spectacles, was a well-regarded Wall Streeter whose star had fallen. A pioneering financier and salesman, he was considered the second leading figure after Salomon Brothers' Louis Ranieri in the development of the mortgage-backed bond market. At the time, Fink was about to lose his job at First Boston after his unit racked up $100 million in losses in early 1988. But Schwartzman and Peterson had, from the start, hoped to launch affiliated investment businesses and thought Fink was the ideal choice to head a new group focused on fixed-income investments, the Wall Street term for bonds and other interest-paying securities. They accepted Fink's explanation that flawed computer software and bad data inputs had triggered the stunning trading losses, and they were further reassured by a conversation Schwartzman had with Bruce Wasserstein, First Boston's co-head of M&A, who had become a friend and frequent tennis partner of Schwartzman's. "Bruce told me that Larry was by far the most gifted person at First Boston," Schwartzman says. Peterson and Schwartzman offered Fink a $5 million credit line to start a joint venture called Blackstone Financial Management, or BFM, which would trade in mortgage and other fixed-income securities. In exchange for the seed money, Blackstone's partners got a 50% stake in the new business, while Fink and his team, which included Ralph Schlosstein, a former Lehman partner and a good friend of Roger Altman's, owned the other 50%. Eventually, the Blackstone partners' stake would fall to around 40% as the BFM staff grew and employees were given shares in the business. Fink also got 2.5% interest in the parent, Blackstone. The arrangement with Fink reflected the Peterson and Schwartzman approach to building up Blackstone. They wanted to recruit top talent, but they were not about to surrender any significant part of Blackstone's ownership. The implosion at Lehman had convinced them that they should keep tight control of the overall business. This was going to be their show. Altman, who might have gotten a bigger stake if he had joined his friend sooner, received a comparatively meager ownership interest of around 4%. Stockman's piece was even smaller. By the spring of 1988, Blackstone had larded its buyout fund with an extra $200 million from investors who signed up after the original closing, pushing the fund's total capital to about $850 million, and it was now scouring the country for investments. It was a heady time for the LBO business, stoked by Drexel's junk bond factory, and the larger corporate world was undergoing one of its periodic paroxysms of mergers and consolidation. There were more than 1,600 mergers in the United States worth nearly $90 billion in the first half of 1988, more than triple the dollar volume 5 years earlier, and on a par with the frenzied level in early 1987. The slump in M&A following the October 1987 stock market crash was swiftly fading from memory. Blackstone was as yet only a mid-sized player in a field that had become more crowded since its launch. A Wall Street bank, Morgan Stanley, had raised $1.1 billion, while Merrill Lynch would close a $1.5 billion fund later that year, and two new Blackstone-style M&A come buyout boutiques had burst onto the scene, with far more hoopla than Blackstone had aroused. The first was formed by First Boston Mergers superstars Bruce Wasserstein and Joseph Perella, who jolted Wall Street when they left First Boston in February 1988 to form Wasserstein, Perella & Company. They talked the cream of First Boston's M&A bankers into joining them, and their names carried enough cachet that they quickly lined up $500 million toward a $1 billion buyout fund. More than anyone else, Wasserstein, 40, a rumpled, paunchy figure with a chess genius's command of tactics, had restyled the genteel M&A business into a sophisticated, high-stakes sport of aggression. He first gained wide attention in 1981 in the $9 billion takeover battle for the oil company Conoco Incorporated, in which he outflanked Mobil Oil Corporation and the liquor giant Seagram Company Limited to win the target for E.I. DuPont de Nemours and Company, his client, despite a lower bid. The intricate tactic he hatched to capture Conoco, called a front-end-loaded two-tier tender offer, was later banned by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. After Conoco, Wasserstein had a hand in some of the biggest takeovers of the mid-1980s, including Texaco's hotly contested $10.8 billion purchase of Getty Oil Company in 1984, and Capital Cities Communications' $3.5 billion acquisition of the ABC television network in 1985. He was known for exhorting gun-shy clients to pull the trigger on topping bids, which earned him a nickname he hated, Bid-'em-up Bruce. Perella, 47, the diametric opposite of his partner in height, girth, and sartorial savoir-faire, was more of a traditional relationship banker in the mold of Peterson and Altman. Wasserstein Perella soon won the backing of Japan's largest stock brokerage, Nomura Securities Company, which that July put up $100 million for a 20% stake in the firm. Most or all of that money ended up being funneled into Wasserstein Perella's buyout fund. Nomura issued a press release expressing its delight at the chance to be an early investor in a firm so obviously destined to be an international M&A powerhouse. Wasserstein Perella looked to be halfway there already, raking in $30 million of M&A fees in its first 4 months. With those fees and the $100 million from Nomura, Wasserstein and Perella were spared the hand-to-mouth existence Peterson and Schwartzman endured for their first 2 years. The other headline-grabbing new firm was Lodestar Group, formed the same month as Wasserstein Perella by Ken Miller, Merrill Lynch's M&A chief and vice chairman, and its highest-paid banker. Miller was not as lionized as Wasserstein and Perella, but he had secured his reputation by making Merrill a first-tier power in M&A and shepherding several high-profile LBOs that Merrill had led, including those of truck trailer maker Fruhoff Corporation and drugstore operator Jack Eckerd Corporation. In July, a day after Nomura announced its investment in Wasserstein Perella, Lodestar unveiled a comparable deal. Yamaichi Securities Company, Japan's fourth-largest brokerage, would put up $100 million of the $500 million LBO fund Miller was raising, and separately inject an undisclosed sum in Lodestar itself for one-quarter of the firm. Blackstone would have had to vie for investors, talent, and deals with these flashier upstarts. None of the new players held a candle to KKR, though. It had recently amassed a $6.1 billion war chest, far and away the biggest buyout fund ever, and controlled about a third of the $15 billion to $20 billion of equity the buyout industry had stockpiled to date. It was no easy task to compete, for KKR was raking in profits on a scale its founders couldn't have imagined a decade earlier. In May 1988, Henry Kravis and the other KKR partners personally pocketed $130 million in profits on just one investment, Store Communications, a broadcaster they had bought just 3 years earlier, which they sold for more than $3 billion. KKR had pulled off gargantuan buyouts of name-brand companies, a $4.8 billion deal for the supermarket chain Safeway in 1986, and the $8.7 billion buyout of Beatrice Foods the same year. Late in 1988, KKR would reassert its dominance when it cinched by far the biggest buyout ever, the $31.3 billion take private of the tobacco and food giant RJR Nabisco, a bid that would define the era, crystallize the public image of private equity investors as buccaneers, and set a record that would not be matched for 18 years. Unlike KKR, though, Blackstone had its M&A business, which by 1988 was capturing its share of Plum M&A assignments. Early that year, Blackstone took in more than $15 million from two jobs alone, handling negotiations for Sony Corporation's $2 billion purchase of CBS Records, an assignment Blackstone picked up from Sony founder Akio Morita, an old friend of Peterson's, and from Sony's top U.S. executive, whom Schwartzman knew, and advising Firestone Tire and Rubber when it sold out to Japan's Bridgestone Incorporated for $2.6 billion, a deal Schwartzman guided. As Peterson and Schwartzman hoped, the M&A business gave the firm access to executives that eventually turned up LBO opportunities. Blackstone's first buyout developed that way. It was puny compared with KKR's big deals, a mere $640 million, but it would have an immense impact on the young firm's image and fortunes. It began when Altman telephoned Donald Hoffman, a top official at USX Corporation, the parent of U.S. Steel. USX was battling for its corporate life with Carl Icahn, the much-feared corporate raider. In 1986, Icahn had amassed a nearly 10% stake in USX and launched an $8 billion hostile takeover bid. U.S. Steel was 3 months into a strike that was crippling steel production and had pummeled the stock. Over the next year, Icahn hectored USX to offload assets and take other steps to boost its share price. To back itself out of a corner and persuade Icahn to go away, USX eventually announced that it would sell more than $1.5 billion in assets and use the money to buy back some of its shares. Companies often buy in shares to boost their share price because that increases the earnings attributable to each individual share. Among the assets USX tabbed for full or partial sale were its rail and barge operations. The plan assuaged Icahn. Altman, Peterson, and Schwartzman flew to Pittsburgh to meet with USX's top brass to see if they could strike a deal for the transport business, which Hoffman headed. In addition to Hoffman, USX Chairman and Chief Executive David Roderick and Charles Corey, the steelmaker's president, were at the meeting. USX hoped to raise $500 million from the sale, but two conflicting goals made it tricky to structure a deal. USX wanted to sell more than 50% of the transport business to an outside party, so that under accounting rules, it could take the unit's debt off its books. However, it didn't want to give up too much control. More than half the railway's business came from other shippers, but U.S. Steel was almost wholly reliant on its subsidiaries' train and barges. The system hauled all the raw materials to U.S. Steel's Midwest plants, and 90% of the company's finished products passed over its lines on the way to customers. Roderick couldn't agree to a sale if the businesses would end up in unfriendly hands. They told us, "This is our lifeline. If anything goes wrong with this, if we sold it to a buyout firm unwilling to invest enough capital, or that held us up for higher transport rates, it could bankrupt us, Schwartzman recalls. Rather than focus on price at the outset, the three Blackstone partners zoomed in on USX's anxieties and how to allay them. The first meeting was not about price, Peterson says. It was about governance. We went over some major operating decisions we'd face, spending levels to maintain the equipment, how we'd set rates, a determination of what to do if either of us wanted to sell our interests, and various other issues. That approach alone wouldn't have won Blackstone the deal, Roderick says. Governance was extremely important to us, but so was price. But the attentiveness Altman, Peterson, and Schwartzman showed to USX's concerns gave the company comfort. The trio convinced Hoffman that they understood our problem very well, he says. They were head and shoulders above any other investment group that I saw. We saw probably five or six. Not everyone at Blackstone was keen on the deal. Back in New York, David Stockman was dead set against it. The partners agonized over doing it. The big concern was how the business would perform if there were a severe slump in the steel market, a common event in that highly cyclical industry that could ravage revenues and profits of the transport unit. It fell to James Mossman, a brilliant 29-year-old banker Altman had lured from Shearson, to digest the patchy data Blackstone had been given. After crunching the numbers, he was enthusiastic about the deal and made his case at a staff meeting. James raised his hand and said, "We need to do this deal. We're going to make a lot of money," says Howard Lipson, a young staffer at the time who helped Mossman draft the financial model. Mossman explained that even though steelmaking is notorious for its ups and downs, the business of shipping steel was much steadier. "We showed that most of the wild cyclicality in steel companies' profits was due to what happened to pricing as volume rose or fell," says Lipson. "Despite that, the railroads are affected only by steel volume, not prices, and volume is not nearly as volatile as prices." Mossman sketched an imaginary worst case. He assumed that steel volume tumbled to its lowest point in 20 years and stayed there for 2 years. He showed, even then, the railroad and barge unit would be able to meet its costs and turn a profit. "James did a perfect analysis," says Schwartzman. Convincing the Blackstone partners was one thing. Persuading banks to finance the deal was another matter. Blackstone needed $500 million of loans or bonds for the spinoff, but it had no track record in buyouts, and bankers were unnerved at the prospect of lending to a highly leveraged business that was dependent on the boom and bust cycles in steel. They weren't moved by Mossman's analysis. Their mindset was they didn't want to go anywhere near a cyclical business, Lipson says. Schwartzman put out calls to all the big New York banks that finance buyouts. Manufacturers Hanover, Citibank, Bankers Trust, Chase Manhattan, and J.P. Morgan. All but J.P. Morgan turned him down flat. The House of Morgan, whose name radiated prestige, had been U.S. Steel's banker since the turn of the century, when J. Pierpont Morgan bought the steelmaker's predecessor from the industrialist Andrew Carnegie. It offered to finance the deal with USX, but it declined to give a firm commitment to come up with the money, and its proposal was loaded with conditions. "We loved the J.P. Morgan name," Schwartzman says, "but reputation alone wouldn't get the deal done." A sixth bank offered much better terms, however. Chemical Bank, like Blackstone's founders, had aspired for years to break into the LBO business, but it had been a distant also-ran in the world of high finance. Mocked for its dismal lending record, Chemical deserved its popular sobriquet, Comical Bank. It would shed that reputation only in the late 1980s, Under the leadership of Walter Shipley and his successor as CEO, Bill Harrison. The two gave Chemicals' new commercial lending chief, James Lee, a 30-something banker, free rein to invigorate Chemicals' loan operation and lead the charge into LBOs. Chemicals simply wasn't big enough to finance large buyouts alone, but Lee got around that limitation by mustering a network of banks that would back the deals he signed up. Canvassing loan officers he'd befriended in Australia, Japan, and Canada, he assembled a core of banks that trusted Chemical and could be counted on to ante up quickly when new lending opportunities came along. By 1984, Lee's syndication apparatus was in place, and he conducted trial runs on a handful of high-rated, low-risk corporate loan packages before he ventured into the dicier realm of buyouts. By the time of the USX rail and barge deal, Lee had notched a handful of small loan syndications for LBOs. To steal a march on other banks, Lee loaded Chemical's $515 million debt package for Blackstone with seductive features. Most important, he gave Blackstone an ironclad promise to provide all the debt, and to do so at a lower interest rate than Morgan. By contrast, Morgan had offered only to make its best efforts to round up the requisite funds, not a binding commitment. To sweeten Chemical's proposal, Lee agreed to drop the interest rate by 0.5 percentage point if the company's profits sprang back to pre-strike levels. To tide the business over if it ran into trouble, Lee further offered $25 million of backup capital in the form of a revolving credit facility, a now conventional part of LBO financing that Lee helped to popularize. This was credit the company could draw on if needed and pay back as it could, unlike the regular loans whose amounts and due dates were fixed. When I walked into Blackstone's offices, I knew I could give them what they wanted, says Lee. I had a firm grip on how much money Chemical could pledge to any deal. Schwartzman, still angling to obtain the imprimatur of the more august J.P. Morgan, went back and asked Morgan to match Chemical's terms. To no avail. Steve let us know he thought J.P. Morgan was classy, and we were not, says Lee. But he said our offer was vastly more clever and creative. And Chemical won the day. First announced on June 21, 1989, the deal closed in December. That month, Blackstone and USX formed a new holding company, Transtar Holding LP, to house the rail and barge operations. As with the famous leveraged buyout of Gibson Greeting in 1982, equity was just a tiny sliver of the total financing package for Transtar. Blackstone shelled out just $13.4 million, 2% of the buyout price, for a 51% ownership stake. The new debt Chemical provided replaced much of the railroad's equity, so USX was able to take out more than $500 million in cash. USX also lent Transtar $125 million in the form of bonds, a kind of IOU known in the trade as seller paper, because it amounted to a loan by USX to help Blackstone finance the purchase. Roderick and USX got what they asked for. Despite holding just 49%, USX shared decision-making power over budgeting, financing, and strategy on equal terms with Blackstone. The transaction was not a classic LBO at all. Strictly speaking, it was a leveraged recapitalization, a restructuring, where debt is added and the ownership is shuffled. But whatever the label, it helped advertise the company-friendly approach that Peterson and Schwartzman had been touting for 3 years now. We really wanted to put meat on our corporate partnership idea, and we hoped this deal did that, Peterson says. It sent a signal that we were good guys who did thoughtful, friendly deals as a real partner. Blackstone got everything it bargained for. a sturdy business on the rebound, which it had snared for an extraordinarily low price of 4 times cash flow. That was 1/3 to 1/2 below the stock market valuations of most railroads. For a buyout investor, cash flow is the axis around which every deal turns. It determines how much debt a company can afford to take on, and thus what a buyer can afford to pay.